This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. The late actress Jean Seberg may be better known in France than she is in her native United States. The Marshalltown native was an entering freshman at the University of Iowa in 1957 when her high school drama coach nominated her for the leading role in film director Otto Preminger's St. Joan, based on the life of Joan of Arc. There were 18,000 contestants for the job, and after grueling auditions, Seberg won and was later literally severely burned at the stake during the making of the movie. She went on to have roles in another 36 movies, including films more known to Americans, including Paint Your Wagon and Airport. This hour, we'll take a look at the dramatic life of the actress. We'll talk to Gary McGee of Northeast Iowa. His new book is Breathless, Jean Seberg. Breathless, of course, a reference to one of her better-known films. Talk of Iowa, following news. This is Iowa Public Radio's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Jean Seberg was active in drama and speech at Marshalltown High School, and after a couple of weeks as a freshman at the University of Iowa in 1957, auditioned for and was chosen for the lead role of director Otto Preminger's St. Joan. She went on to make lots of movies and is beloved by the French. Iowan Gary McGee has written a new biography of Seberg called Breathless. Gary, it's nice to talk to you. You know, the life of Iowan Jean Seberg is truly a fascinating life. It's to read about it in your book, Jean Seberg, Breathless. Overall, Jean Seberg is a figure that especially as Iowans, should remember. Is that your feeling?
Oh, yes, definitely. That's why one of the reasons why I wrote the book was so that Iowans would learn about her and what a significant figure she was, especially in the 1960s. Not just in Iowa or the United States, but internationally as well.
Her career started so quickly. I mean, she had just gotten out of Marshalltown High School, graduating in 1957, right? And decides to apply, if that's the word, for a part in the movie St. Joan, which was Otto Preminger's production. Tell us a little bit about that story and how she eventually won out.
Well, with the film St. Joan, there was a publicity campaign internationally for young women to apply for the role, and apparently there were 18,000 applicants from around the world. But Jean, she did not apply for it, for the role herself. There were couple other people who had submitted her name, and then only when she was asked to go to Chicago for a tryout did she think, well, I might as well try this. Perhaps she felt that she would make some contacts in the film industry, but she did not feel that she would get the role that some established actress would ultimately get the role of. And but then she was chosen out of the 18,000 by Preminger, and that really, you know, that was the beginning of her career. It wasn't the path that she envisioned. She felt that she would go to school at the University of Iowa. In fact, she was enrolled at the U of I at the time, and then that would lead to off-Broadway roles, and then, you know, more stage roles in New York. And then, hopefully, an eventual film or movie in Hollywood. But so that was a very unusual path that her career took at that time.
You know, it's just mind-boggling, Gary, that she came out number one when there were 18,000 contestants for this role. And I'm sure many were more well-known actresses, and she's literally at the University of Iowa for just a matter of days in her freshman year, and she convinces Otto Preminger that she's the person for this part. But she went through a fair amount of work to get the role, including a number of, I guess you could say, small auditions as she with Preminger himself when she was, you know, the last two or three finalists, right?
Yeah, yes. they went through extensive rehearsals and things like that. When it came down to the final three, I believe, finalists for the role, and at one point, Preminger asked her if she could would mind cutting her hair, because at the time she wore it shoulder length, and I think Jean realized that this was not a fluke, that it was a possibility that she could get the role. So of course she allowed them to cut her hair, and I think she was a bit shocked when she first saw herself with her short hair, but little did she know at that time that they became an iconic.
Well, she kept the short hair then basically for the rest of her life, except maybe for one role.
Yeah, for the most part, Jean did wore her hair short. Sometimes it was shorter than other times. I know in the mid-70s, she didn't have it go back to the shoulder length for a bit. You know, to this day, people remember that the short hairstyle that Jean made famous. And there were other celebrities who copied that same look, including Mia Farrow, and she's more or less remembered for that style rather than Jean Seberg, but it was Jean who made that quite popular. And again, to this day, she is known for her one of many things, but her hairstyle.
Well, in case people haven't seen her, she was an extraordinarily beautiful woman, no doubt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Gary, let's talk about her early life. Jean Seberg growing up in Marshalltown, Iowa. Her father was a pharmacist, her mother a substitute teacher, Dorothy and Ed Seberg. Ed's background was Swedish. His parents were from Sweden. But her background was sort of typical middle class, you know, Lutheran church, Iowa public schools. There really wasn't anything extraordinary about her upbringing, was there?
No, not really when you look back, other than it was an ideal situation growing up in a household as Jean did, the closeness of family and friends and neighbors.
Well, nothing terrible happened to her as a child. It was a stable family. They stayed together. She was pretty close to her sister, and then got involved in drama at Marshalltown High School. And speech, she had some very good teachers, a very excellent drama coach, right?
Oh, yes. Carol Houghton Hollingsworth was the high school drama teacher at Marshalltown High School. Jean became very good friends with her, and Carol really saw the potential in Jean before anyone else did. And Carol encouraged her, but Carol also told her that, and I'm quoting her, it isn't all beer and Skittles. So she was just, pretty much warning Jean that more than likely nothing will happen with an acting career. And if fame does come your way, to just be aware that there are downfalls associated with fame.
And as it turned out, there were a lot of downfalls for her, and tragically, throughout her life. But let's get back to October 21st, 1956. She was cast in St. Joan, Otto Preminger's film. It was supposed to be just a huge film. The talent search costing $150,000 worldwide publicity, and then she was in for the ride of her life, starring in this movie. It was a difficult movie to film, and Otto Preminger was sort of a tyrant. And I'm not sure from reading your book whether we appreciate him or hate him. It's sort of hard to tell. He was very talented, but he was also really hard on his crew and stars.
Otto Preminger. Thankfully for him, Jean Seberg was discovered. Who knows if she would have otherwise. But Preminger was a very difficult man, unfortunately. He was very hard on most of his cast whenever they would make films, and Jean was not alone in being berated by him. Many of the actors and actresses who have worked with him, really the majority of them who had worked with Preminger had said the same thing, that he was a tyrant, and many refused to work with him a second or third time. So Gene, you know, that was not an isolated case, but that was Gene's introduction into the film world, and again, it was, I'm sure, very hard for her to deal with that. She did have some close friends with the cast who supported her, so that helped. But then again, Jean later said that she felt that she was never as good an actress as she was before filming St. Joan.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I guess it's hard to understand exactly what she went through with Preminger. I suppose it's like having a boss and you cannot leave work because you have to work, but you have this terrible boss who keeps going after you. So I guess we can relate in a way.
Mm-hmm. And she was, what, 18 years old and, mm-hmm. and in a major film. It had to be just an extraordinary time for her. And they knew each other for a few more years after the movie. She was under contract with him, but eventually he just more or less dumps her and doesn't want anything more to do with her, right?
Right. They had made a second film together, Bonjour, Tristesse, which was more successful than St. Joan, but still mixed reviews. Today, however, it's regarded as a minor classic, which is redeeming for Seberg. They mutually agreed that this was not going to work out, so Preminger sold her contract to Columbia Pictures. And so Jean was then under contract to Columbia. And that was pretty much the end of it. Any time spent with Preminger or anything like that, they would run into each other once in a while and things like that, but it was not nothing more than small talk, if even that.
Gary McGee, as we go to break, here is audio of director Otto Preminger in 1957, saying he wants to discover a talent to play Joan of Arc. Later in the clip, we hear him talking to Gene Seberg.
Since I read Bernard Shaw's St. Joan many, many years ago, it was my dream to film it. And when this dream met its realization, and I had to make a decision about casting the leading part, I decided to find a new, young, unknown actress for it. I started a worldwide search, which met with equally worldwide skepticism.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your name?
My name is Jean Seberg.
Where were you born?
In Marshalltown, Iowa.
When?
November 13th, 1938.
That makes you what age?
17. And 11 months.
And 11 months, almost 18.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to be an actress?
Very badly.
Gene Seberg. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese, talking to author Gary McGee. He lives in Iowa. His book is called Gene Seberg, Breathless, a fabulous book about a most interesting Iowan, an actress who was certainly more known in Europe than she ever was in the United States, Gene Seberg. And I suppose it would be fair to say that St. Joan was a bomb. I mean, unfortunately, and not only did it bomb, Jean was, and the final scene was actually when she was being burned at the stake. She was actually, due to a technical error, actually suffered some real burns. Can you describe that?
Right. Apparently, when they were filming the execution, something was not set right with the propane tanks. And so this burst of flames went up, and Jean had received burns on her. Her hair was singed, and her stomach was burnt, and those scars on her stomach stayed with her until her death. And I recall being told that when the filming of that was taking place, the cameras continued rolling, so part of that scene is in the finished film of Saint Joan, in which you actually see the explosion and Jean trying to cover her face. And apparently, the stagehands went in to try to put out the flames and pull Jean down. And Preminger was quite angry about that because they had ruined his shot.
That was his main concern.
Yeah, that was his main concern. Mm-hmm. But here, St. Joan, looking at it today, one has to remember Joan of Arc was a teenager. She maybe not in full control of her emotions, not unlike a teenager. And so when we watch the film today, Jean, you know, has that confusion of, you know, what is she supposed to feel? And she knows what's right as Joan of Arc. And trying to explain and try to get people to understand her in that role, I find more fault with Preminger's direction and some of the co-stars and their interpretation of their characters. It's an interesting film, but when the film came out, it was Jean that was just slaughtered by the critics.
Yeah.
In the United States. Mm-hmm. However, in France, she was very much appreciated.
Gary Jean is quoted as saying about her movie Saint Joan, "I have two memories of Saint Joan. The first was being burned at the stake in the picture. The second was being burned at the stake by the critics. The latter hurt more. I was scared like a rabbit, and it showed on the screen. It was not a good experience at all. I started where most actresses end up." Anyway, she, again, as you mentioned, does a second movie with Otto Preminger, Bonjour Tristesse. Am I saying it right? I know you said it earlier.
Yep.
And that was more highly regarded, but still not a big hit.
Right. That Bonjour Tristesse was received, you know, a lot more by the critics and the movie-going public. Certainly made more money than St. Joan did. But again, it was not the hit that Preminger envisioned, and it was based on a best-selling novel, so you know, that was something that was tied in with the film. But again, in France, Jean was applauded for the role, so that was quite interesting. So it seemed like everything good was coming from France.
I think it's fair to say that she took well to France and living in Paris. She just loved it pretty much right from the start, although she said a couple of times later in later years that she was still an American at heart, but she loved Paris, didn't she?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And see, the French embraced her, and to this day they regard her as their little American, and that's wonderful to hear. You know, in her adopted country, that she still remembered.
While she's making these first couple of pictures, she runs into Francois Marais, ends up marrying him, and it wasn't really a very good match, was it?
You know, in the beginning, I think it was because Francois really gave her the attention she needed, and this was when she was making Bonjour Tristesse, and the tyranny of Otto Preminger was continuing. Francois comforted her and listened to her and assured her. They had met at this one estate, and I do recall Jean was water skiing, and that's how Francois first, that was his first introduction to Jean. And I believe, yes, Francois told me that it was a huge party going on, and Charlie Chaplin was there, and I do have photographs from that first meeting, and you know, you do see this admiration for each other, even though they had just met. But you do see that in these photos.
Mm-hmm.
As for marriage, Jean admitted years later that it was a mistake, and she did feel she was upset that she had hurt his feelings by divorcing him, and Francois did not realize that until many, many years later when I told him about what Jean really felt.
Well, she's married to Francois for a couple of years, and the great love of her life, Romain Gary, the French author and diplomat, highly regarded, she ends up marrying in 1962. Let's talk a little bit about this very interesting man and how they met.
Gene was in Hollywood filming Let No Man Write My Epitaph, which was with Ella Fitzgerald and Burl Ives and Shelley Winters. And she had just a very, very small role that Columbia had cast her in. And I believe that was after she had done The Mouse That Roared. And after that, it had come out and been a huge success. And when she was in Los Angeles, Francois suggested that they leave his calling card at the French Consul General, because that's the way Francois was raised, that when visiting a foreign country, one does such things. So they did, and they were invited to dinner one evening with Romain. I believe Francois had to go back to Paris, and he asked Romain to please take care of Jean, because she's all alone. She doesn't know anyone here in Los Angeles, and Romain said that he would. And what developed was a friendship, and then eventually they fell in love with each other.
He was much older by, 20 years or something, or maybe more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a very complicated relationship, but they were married for about 8 years through most of the 1960s. And even after they broke up in 1970, we'll get to that, but he still cared deeply for her, and she cared deeply for him. And I just think it was a true friendship. At least it carried on till the end of her life. Is that your feeling?
Oh, yes, definitely. I believe Romain was the great love of Jean's life, despite the age difference. She learned a lot from him, and vice versa. You know, he was not exposed to the Midwestern lifestyle or the values, what a stable family was like, anything like that. And he learned that from Jean. And it was till her death, they remained very, very good friends.
Yeah. And a son resulted from their marriage. Actually, he was conceived before they were married. And she tried to cover that up, but Diego was born really in 1962, not 1963. But she wanted to make it seem like, he was conceived after they were actually married. But the truth eventually came out. Not that it was a huge deal, really, but maybe it was more of a big deal at the time.
Yes, I believe. I think that had a lot to do with Romain. The changing of their son's birth certificate, and because Romain was within the French government, he was good friends with President de Gaulle. Romain was also married at the time, so even though he had been seeking divorce for several years, he was married to the British novelist Leslie Blanche.
No question that she loved her son very, very much. Gary, we need to take a break. Be back in just about 5 minutes after news. Gary McGee, author of Gene Seberg, Breathless. Gary lives in northeast Iowa. We'll take a break on Talk of Iowa, continue our conversation about the life of Iowan Gene Seberg, born in Marshalltown, Iowa, 1938, died in 1979. Talk of Iowa continues in a few minutes on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese, talking this hour with author Gary McGee. He lives in northeast Iowa. His book, Gene Seberg, Breathless, published by Bear Manor Media, a most fascinating young woman who started out with just a remarkable rise to the top, winning a contest as a new freshman at the University of Iowa, but a contest to appear in St. Joan, Otto Preminger's movie. And then she moves to Paris, and we're talking about her career. Gary, your book is called Breathless, Life of Gene Seberg, but based on the movie Breathless, of course. Is Breathless, filmed in 1959, considered her most famous movie, do you think?
Well, this year I think it is, because this is the 50th anniversary of Breathless, and it has been it has been remastered and cleaned up, and now is playing in a few theaters in the United States. But of course, she's done other films. I know Americans remember her in Paint Your Wagon.
Yeah.
And the original Airport.
Right. I mean, what do you think of Breathless? I haven't seen it, and I need to see it. I should see it. But what do you think of the movie?
You know, I saw that film, I don't know how many times, taking film courses. And they use that film as a tool to teach students different methods of filmmaking. It is, one needs to view that film and take it in the context of its time, which is 50 years ago. It was interesting. It was groundbreaking in its time, and of course, since then, several filmmakers have copied from Breathless. She always wanted to do another film that would be as important as Breathless became. But then, unfortunately, when you think about it, how many actors or actresses are actually part of a groundbreaking film? Because, you know, they're in successful films and, you know, critical acclaimed films. But what about groundbreaking that really influenced future filmmakers? So I don't know if Jean ever realized that she was really part of this one small group who actually was part of a film that was that changed the history of cinema.
Well, let's talk about Paint Your Wagon. She travels to the United States to film this in rural Oregon to start with, and ends up becoming romantically involved with, of all people, Clint Eastwood.
It could have been Lee Marvin.
Yeah, well,
but he drank too much.
Yeah, he certainly did.
And he admitted it. So, yeah. Clint Eastwood. Uh-huh. Yeah, Gene had an affair with him and fell in love with him. It was not reciprocated, so
yeah.
It ended, and I don't think it ended very well, because Clint will not speak about Gene, and it's a shame. It's a shame.
He won't speak about Gene at all?
I think he said about two lines in this one biography that he did. He fell head over heels with her, and that was about it. So,
well, this had to be indicative that things maybe weren't going very well with her marriage to Roman Gary. We're talking about the late 60s right now, and they were sort of drifting apart. This may have been due to age, or maybe just she seemed to tire of things easily and wanted to move on and to new challenges all the time, didn't she? Was that maybe that was part of her personality? But the marriage wasn't going especially well by the late 60s, was it?
Well, right before she did Paint Your Wagon, she did a film called Birds in Peru, which was directed by Roman, as well as written by Roman, and that was the first film he ever directed. I know she said privately that she was very upset with the way it turned out and the things that she was required to do in the film. And in the film, she plays an nymphomaniac who cannot find fulfillment. So that, I think that is a clue as to why she became disenchanted with their marriage.
It was almost as if she was being asked by her husband to do some scenes that were just a little bit too risque for the time, even though by today's standards, I suppose they're pretty modest. If we were to see the film today, maybe there was no nudity, at least not on her part, was there?
No, there's no nudity. It was just the simulation of things that she was required to do. And I did see the film. It is one of the rare ones. And Gene said publicly it was a work of art. that's what I look at it, or how I saw it was, you know, this is a work of art. The photography was beautiful. It's just it's a shame that it's available to the public, as a lot of her films are not available.
Oh, really? So you can't even find them on DVD from some catalog somewhere?
Oh, no. I'd say maybe 18 or 19 of her 37 films aren't available. No. But I know they do exist. And, in fact, two of the films that I feared had been lost, two copies exist in Rome in this library. So everything is accounted for. However, they're spread throughout the world.
She also resented to a certain extent that her husband, Roman Gary, seemed to use her as a character in some of his novels and maybe not portraying her in the best light. She was not happy about that.
Yeah, Jean had said that a few times. At times she was flattered and other times not. I think she did accept the fact that she was being used as a character in his novels. And in fact, in one novel, White Dog, he used her by name, used Jean's name throughout the whole book. And one doesn't know what is fiction and what is nonfiction.
Let me ask you just about her parents for a minute. She had been in Paris for some years, and she really tried to keep in close contact with Dorothy and Ed Seeberg in Marshalltown, Iowa. She wrote lots of letters. She visited many times. By the 70s, when things were not going well at all, that all changed. But she loved her parents, and did she not? Especially your grandmother, the dear grandmother, visited, and Jean sent her a check every month, I believe. She loved her a lot, didn't she?
Oh, yes, and Jean's grandma, Frances Benson, was just an amazing woman. And but Jean, Jean visited her family, and she came back to Iowa many times. It just was not documented. She didn't do that for publicity reasons, and it's surprising that people feel to this day that, she never came back once she made it big. Well, that's not true. You have to remember also, this is some of this was before the jet set age, where it was traveling was not all that easy, and Jean still made the effort. But again, by the 1970s, her traveling to the United States was just a handful of times, but that was not because of her family or Marshalltown or anything like that. It had to do with many other reasons, which I write about in the book.
Yeah. What did Marshalltown think of Jean Seeberg through the years?
I've heard many different things. Like there's three groups. One group is very proud of her. Another group feels she got what she deserved, whatever that means. And another group has no idea who Jean Seeberg is.
And after she died, her family tried to donate some of her papers and personal artifacts to the State Historical Society, and whoever answered the phone hadn't even heard of her. Is that the correct story?
Yes, that's what I was told.
Let's talk about her activism. By the late 60s, she's very sympathetic to the cause of African Americans, the civil rights movement, and she becomes involved with the Black Panthers. And Gary, maybe you could tell the story of how this happened and the unfortunate outcome of this involvement, and which is a very embarrassing episode for the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, what happened. Can you tell the story?
Well, embarrassing, too, for the U.S. news media, very much.
Newsweek magazine, for example, right?
Exactly. Jean was always interested in different causes from the time she was a little girl, from abandoned animals, and as well as with humans and the different races and how people were treated and the different social classes and how unfair she felt that was to be judged by how fancy your house is or how much your car costs. She was not impressed with that at all. So when Jean was living in Paris, she was really somewhat removed from what was happening in the United States. When she came to film Paint Your Wagon, she was here many, many months. And she became involved with different groups, including the Black Panther Party. And Jean had donated money to their cause because she viewed them not as a militant group, as the news media portrayed them as, but as a group who was trying to make a difference. And it was the Panthers' free breakfast program which allowed children to have a free breakfast every day. And that is what she initially gave money toward. And it's surprising that a few years after that, the U.S. government thought that was a good idea, so they implemented that into their public school system. So with Jean and the Black Panthers, the FBI, of course, had been following members of the Panthers and people who were supporting them because they viewed them as the greatest threat to our national security. And so it came out that Jean was pregnant with her second child, and this was in the spring of 1970. The FBI felt that they needed to discredit Jean because she was an influential figure at that time. And so they thought if they discredit her, then she would not get movie roles, she would not have money, she could not give money to groups like the Black Panthers. So what they did, what suggested was to send a note that the father of Jean's unborn child was not Roman, but a black militant she had met in California. And eventually the LA Times ran the story as a blind item. They did not want to use her name because they could not verify whether or not the story was true. However, Newsweek magazine printed it as fact without even getting a hold of Jean to find out if the story was true or not.
And the author of that article on Newsweek later admitted that she should have checked her facts, and Jean and Roman, I guess, took out a lawsuit in Paris against Newsweek, which ended up in Jean's favor. But the damage, a lot of damage had been done, and just inexcusable how the FBI behaved. And I guess later, Gary, Director Webster, later in the 70s, admitted that, well, this happened, but we don't act this way anymore. But again, a lot of damage had already been done, of course.
Right, Webster said that right after Jean had died, and all this came out to the public through the Freedom of Information Act, and that was the only thing that was said about it publicly by the FBI.
Her father, Ed, was very embittered by this whole experience. After he learned what happened, he was, I guess you could say, one of those guys that probably had the American flag in his front yard for those years in Marshalltown, but once he heard how the FBI had treated his daughter, he was absolutely shocked and dismayed, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, definitely. See, Ed Seberg, I believe, was a very conservative, Republican, straight-laced father figure, husband figure, and outstanding citizen in the community. And then shortly after Jean died and the truth came out about the FBI involvement in her life, and Jean was a liberal, a free spirit in the eyes of many people. Ed, when he heard the news, he went out to the front yard of his home and took down the U.S. flag, rolled it up, and put it in the corner of his house, I believe behind his chair, and it stayed there. He never again flew the flag outside of his home.
Another tragic part of Jean Seberg's life was the premature birth and death of the daughter Nina, and it's been said by a lot of people that Jean never recovered from her daughter's death, and maybe did she blame the FBI just for the stress and tension that may have resulted in this premature birth?
Yes, Jean blamed the FBI for all that went wrong. as well as Newsweek. Now, she did not blame Joyce Haber or the L.A. Times because the L.A. Times had printed that story as a blind item, but it was really Newsweek. She cannot, and Jean's sister has told me this, she just could not get over what Newsweek had done, and especially since there was no answers to the questions she had, like, why did you do this to me? What is going on here? You know, who above you holds something on you that resulted in you running this lie about me? None of that. And to this day, Newsweek has yet to respond because I've written to them. And it's really unfortunate.
Talking to Gary McGee, an Iowa author, his book is Jean Seberg, Breathless, the Life of the Famous Marshalltown Iowa Actress Who Lived in Paris for Most of Her Life, Died Tragically. But the 70s were not a good decade for her. She did still make some films, though, post-1970. I wanted to mention, you know, she gave away, she made a lot of money in her life, and she was not careful with her money, but she gave away just an incredible amount of money, loaning it to friends who never repaid, and to charities. She was very generous, but by the 70s, she was pretty much out of money.
Yes, Jean gave a lot away, and her sister said that, you know, anytime someone would ask for something, you know, Jean felt, you know, if they needed it, then it was worth giving.
And in the last few years of her life, she had, I guess you would say, the supreme misfortune of running into an Algerian by the name of Ahmed Hosni, who really took advantage of her. There's just no other way to describe that, is there?
Yeah, that is, that's just a very bizarre episode in her life that she tried to dissolve their relationship, but something, we don't know exactly what happened. Many people feel that he was involved with Jean's death. One way or another, I do know for a fact he took all of her personal effects and sold them and pocketed the money after Jean had died. In fact, Diego has nothing of his mother's except what was found in her car at the time of her death. So, you know, Ahmed Hosni has disappeared off the face of the earth, and no one knows what's happened to him.
Gary, let's just briefly go over those last few days. She retires. She goes to bed with Ahmed Hosni, and he wakes up and she's disappeared. This is in late August 1979. In the next few days are very bizarre and hard to understand as to what happened. It seemed like the police were slow. The Paris police were slow to respond to this missing person's case, and it's not sure. I'm not sure why they took. They seem to have taken a few days even to get around to looking into this. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I really don't know what they were thinking. The car that Jean was in was found very close to her apartment, and I went to that street, and there are embassies near there. There's a university two blocks away. It is just amazing that the car had not been found, and that's why other eyewitnesses had said that the car was at different locations throughout the district in Paris. This was not a suicide, I feel. Something happened. Unfortunately, the French police did not investigate. Even though Jean was a U.S. citizen, the State Department, U.S. State Department did nothing as far as investigating her death either. A lot of unanswered questions.
Gary, you've been obviously very interested in Jean Seberg's life for a long time, and it's such an incredible story. I mean, why? What's the importance to all of us of Jean Seberg's life?
Well, she was a humanitarian as well as an actress, and in Iowa especially, I feel we should remember her because many people around the world know where Iowa is because of Jean Seberg. She has a fan base in Japan and South America to this day, and throughout Europe, not just in France. And she never disregarded her home, even though citizens have disregarded her. She never talked down about Iowa. And I really feel that she should be recognized as one of our famous citizens. And in fact, I know when I was in France, several people asked about Marshalltown and if there was a museum about Jean there in Marshalltown. And I did not have the heart to tell them there's really nothing to recognize Jean in her hometown, let alone the state.
That's amazing. I know you're working on a documentary of her life. How is that going?
It's coming along very nicely, and I'm working on it with Kelly and Tammy Rundle of Fourth Wall Films, and we do have a website for people to visit, and it talks about Jean and how the film is progressing, and we're looking at a 2011 release date, and at this time we're finishing up some more interviews as well as getting ready to start the editing process later this year.
Gary, thanks so very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Dennis.
Gary McGee, his book is Breathless, The Life of Jean Seberg, published by Bear Manor Media. That's Talk of Iowa for this Monday. Production assistance today from Christoph Mai. I'm Dennis Reese. Thanks for listening.